So take an alert but comfortable posture and gently close your eyes. And then at the beginning of a meditation, it's nice to take a couple of deep breaths. And as you breathe in, to use the in-breath to connect to the body, to arrive in the body. And then as you breathe out, to relax and settle into your place here. And then relaxing whatever muscles that might be tight and tense, if it's easy to relax. And soften your forehead, the face and the jaws. And you can soften your shoulders, perhaps. Sometimes it's possible to relax or soften the stomach. And then within the body, as part of the body, allow the body's experience of breathing to come to your awareness. Become aware of how it is for the body to be breathing. Letting go of your thoughts and concerns. Simply allowing the breathing to be the center of your experience, to fill this particular corner of the universe, which is you. And when you find your mind wandering off, softly come back to the experience of breathing. And there are two things about staying with the breath. There is bringing your attention into the breath, letting it connect with the breath, and then it's sustaining the attention there, maintaining the attention on the comings and goings of in-breath and out-breath, not without straining, but without being too casual, showing some interest in the experience of breath. The spirit of meditation is to allow all things to be as they are, not to resist, not to manipulate, not to make it different, not to hold on, to make it always stay the same. Allow whatever is happening. In the midst of that, be aware. Be aware of the breathing. When the mind wanders away, then softly come back to the breath, sensing it, feeling it. When strong experiences arise in the body, then let your attention rest there, being with that, making that the meditation. When strong emotions and feelings arise, let your awareness rest there, being with that as long as it's strong. When strong currents of thinking occur, let your attention rest there, not in the content of the thoughts, but in the energetic event of thinking. And when you're not sure, come back to the breathing in the most simple, gentle way, letting your mind, letting your heart settle and rest in the simple experience of breathing. remembering whenever you can to establish a soft connection with the breathing, and then sustaining the connection through time. And one way to help with this is to stay aware of the full cycle of breathing, including the end of the end of the exhalation. The end of the out-breath is a kind of a letting go. And without emphasizing or pushing, or just be there consciously for that letting go at the end of the out-breath. And then be there as the in-breath arises on its own. So today is the fifth day of our 5-week introductory course in mindfulness meditation, and it's the last day. And then next Thursday and the following Thursdays, we revert to our usual schedule of sitting here. And that is, we at 7 o'clock we come and we sit for 30 minutes meditation. And then we have 45 minutes for a talk and some discussion. And then we usually end then with 15 minutes more meditation at the end of the evening. So we try to end by 8:30. And in a sense, the next week and the next few weeks that I'm here, it's just a kind of continuation of the introductory course. I kind of continue with themes that are relevant for more beginner instructions. But today is the fifth week, and I thought it might be nice just briefly to review the overall instructions in a simple way. The simplest way of describing mindfulness meditation is to rest your attention with whatever is predominant in your experience. So whatever is strongest, whatever most wants your attention, yes, we give your attention. So if there's an itch and the itch is really strong, that becomes the meditation. If there's a sound outside and it's really strong, and that becomes the meditation. However, what we try to do is to use the breath as an anchor for the meditation practice, for our anchor in the present moment. Because as many of you probably found out or know, there's a tremendously strong tendency for the mind to get caught up in concerns, in thoughts about the future, the past, fantasies, conversations, whatever. And then it kind of gets lost. It doesn't really know what's happening in the present moment. So the breath is kind of an anchor that kind of brings us back, holds us in the present moment, in the ocean of the present moment. So we place the breath in the foreground of our attention. We give some priority to the breath when we do meditation practice, this mindfulness practice. And we just simply feel it. And the more intimately you can sense it, feel it from the inside. The Buddha's instructions was feel the be mindful of the breath within the breath. Be aware of the body within the body. Not to have a kind of dualistic relationship as if you're up here watching it, but really to feel it intimately as an organic, sensual thing that's partly who you are. So we start with the breath and we sense it and feel it. And as it becomes an anchor, and it becomes a place where we strengthen our capacity to stay alert and aware in the present moment. And it's a skill that gets learned over time. It isn't like you can automatically stay in the, decide to stay with the breath or decide to stay in the present moment, and that's it. You do it forever. It's like a muscle that needs to be strengthened. I once calculated that by the time that a person is 30 years old, I forget the figure, but most of us have spent about 9 million minutes maybe. Letting the mind wander freely wherever it wants, much more than we ever tried to keep it in the present moment. So there is a certain kind of habit momentum that's been formed. And part of what mindfulness is about is kind of weakening that habit of being preoccupied in thoughts and all that, and coming and learning to rest more fully and alively in the experience of the present moment. And luckily, it's not a one-to-one correlation. You don't have to do 9 million minutes of mindfulness in order to kind of... there's a way in which once you bring attention, start doing the practice, it speeds up. But it is kind of like a muscle, the muscle of attention that gets strengthened as we keep trying to bring our attention back to the present moment. So the breath is both an anchor and a place where we strengthen that ability. But the breath is not the be-all and end-all of the meditation practice. Because really, the meditation practice is not a technique at all. But it's just a way of learning how to bring full attention, full awareness to our life as it unfolds for us. And so there's a flexibility, not to be locked on the breath all the time, but if something else arises in our experience which is stronger than our ability to be with the breath, that's where our attention goes, and we feel that and sense that from the inside. So if you have strong sensations in your body, your knee is uncomfortable, your back is uncomfortable, rather than fighting it, rather than running away from it, rather than ignoring it, rather than swearing at it, we just bring our attention and just rest it there, which is a very, very different thing than most people are taught in our culture. We were usually taught to try to avoid pain at all costs. And in this meditation, we're taught, if the pain is strong, to go and place your attention there and see what happens. Keep the attention there and watch the arising and passing of it, being aware that sometimes it takes a long time before it passes. Just keep there with it. Or if great pleasant sensations arise in the body, which they do sometimes, not to kind of indulge in them and kind of surf on them as if this is the greatest thing and you're the hottest meditator around, but simply to bring your attention to that and feel that and sense that from the inside, being aware, mindful of what's happening. If strong feelings arise in the body, or strong emotions arise, note that and make that the meditation. And that becomes the center of the spiritual life, just feeling those emotions when they're there. Not to get caught in it, not to justify, not to criticize, not to do anything with them except just see them and allow them to be there. Maybe to respect their right to be there. They're just there. Just there they are. With emotions, it's particularly useful to feel them as bodily experiences, because one of the places we get caught so much is in our stories, in the stories we make, which then leaves the present moment. So rather than getting caught up in the stories, to feel an emotion as an embodied event, or yield or open the body itself to the emotional experiences. Not to act on it or indulge in it, not to fuel it, but to give it its freedom in a sense. If you're angry, you don't act and express the anger in meditation, but you certainly don't repress it. You give it its freedom to see what it wants to do within you, you know, outside of your agenda. And the same thing if great happiness arises in meditation, or great peace. What happens to it if you don't have an agenda about what it means? Now I've gotten it, a great communion with the ultimate. This is really great. You've made something out of it. Just allow it to be there. And this is what it is. And the same thing with thoughts. If thoughts become very strong, if they're relatively weak, that the practice is just to come back to the breath, come back to what else is happening in the present. But if its thoughts become very strong, they become the center of attention. They become the meditation. That's where our life energy is flowing. And wherever our life energy is most strong, that's where we want to keep our attention, bring our attention. To discover and explore and investigate, what is this experience? In the case of thoughts, what is the experience? What is the event of thinking? And again, the content, the story of the thoughts are not important. But what is it like energetically in the body? As you think really strong thoughts, do you tighten around your forehead? Do your eyes tighten up? Do your shoulders get tense? Do your stomach get tense? Your throat get tense? You know, what happens in your body when you think certain thoughts? And then hang out with that bodily expression of it. What happens emotionally when you think certain thoughts? Usually compulsive thinking has an emotional aspect to it. So you connect to the emotional aspect, and what does that feel like in the body? Because this is what's happening in the present moment. And the beauty of this practice is that it doesn't deny anything. And it's not a technique that makes you kind of lock onto one aspect of your experience at the expense of everything else. But it's really a method, a way, to help us live our life much more fully as it is. And so that idea of a technique kind of falls away, and just awareness itself of whatever is going on. And we talk in this practice sometimes about what's called choiceless awareness. At some point, when the concentration is quite strong and the mind is no longer easily, you know, going off into all kinds of crazy thoughts and ideas and whatever, and you can stay in the present moment, then there's no longer necessary even to stay with the breath as a primary focus or anchor. But the awareness becomes choiceless, allowing all things to be, and you're kind of clearly aware of whatever's arising in the present moment. It's a beautiful thing to do. So that's kind of, and so we've talked about the breath, the body, emotions, and thoughts. And the idea being that, in a kind of general sense, that these four areas of experience represent all possible experiences we can have as a human being, as direct experiences. We can have, you know, bodily experiences, emotional experiences, cognitive experiences. And there are other things also, but they kind of subsumed under these. And as you continue the practice, you understand this simple categorization. The idea is that we open to everything. Nothing's excluded from what we bring our attention to. And because nothing's excluded, there's a possibility of freedom, which in Buddhism is not just simply not only bringing awareness to experience, but bringing an awareness which in no way clings or holds on or is entrapped or reactive to any experience. And that's called a free heart or a free mind, that experience. And in a sense, that's the point of Buddhist practice. The point of Buddhist practice is not to stay in the present moment. And this is kind of a little bit important point. So you don't get all neurotic about staying in the present moment, like you have to be there all the time. The point of the present moment is to... The point of Buddhist practice is to have a heart which is freed of all its clinging, all its worry, all its fear, all its anxiety, all the ways it clings and holds on for security and whatever it wants. And bringing our attention into the present moment is a very powerful way of discovering that. So that's kind of the very simple, basic idea of a kind of review of the practice. At this point, if you have a little bit of sense of what the practice is as a meditation practice, there's two ways to continue and deepen the practice. And one way is to do more meditation practice, to really kind of throw yourself into meditation practice and to develop more a deeper concentration in doing the mindfulness practice. Because mindfulness itself is not necessarily concentration practice, but if we couple mindfulness with concentration, you can actually go much deeper in our experience, have much more penetrating insight into what's going on in the present moment than we can if we have just kind of a casual awareness. And so by developing a stronger concentration of really staying in the present moment and keeping it sustained there for quite a long time and looking very carefully, being very precisely aware in a non-stressful way, what's happening in the present moment, just really being fixed on the breath, really if something else arises, really being there for that in a careful way and not allowing in any kind of way the mind to wander off into stray thoughts or future or past or whatever. And of course this is something that takes developing, it's not necessarily easy, but as this develops you kind of feel, experience what sometimes I call sometimes I call it a vision to myself, I don't know if it makes any sense to anyone else, kind of like a yo-yo mind. You know, you throw your yo-yo out and it comes right back. So the mind begins to go out by itself into some stray thought because the power of the mindfulness and concentration, it doesn't go very far and your mind, your attention, your energy comes right back into the present moment. And it kind of does it by itself. You don't have to do it even after a while. And it's really you stay there and you're kind of kept in the present moment. Certain concentration gets developed. And from this comes very deep experiences of insight, of freedom, of liberation, of compassion, that in some ways is an important aspect of Buddhist spirituality. So that's one way to take the practice, is to develop it with greater concentration. The other way to develop the practice is to extend it into our daily life. Because what many people discover, if they do a meditation practice for some time, is that the mind of meditation and the mind outside of meditation is the same mind. The heart in and outside of meditation is the same heart. And the boundary or the distinction between a meditative being and a non-meditative state of being is rather arbitrary. And when you realize that arbitrary nature, then I think it becomes natural to want to extend the practice into our normal life. Because if you just begin discovering in meditation a certain kind of personal integrity, a certain kind of feeling of a personal wholeness that is not swayed by our fears and our identifications and our worries and whatever, I think it's natural to want to see, can I find that integrity in my normal life also? Can I bring attention, careful attention to other areas of my life and develop, have those be places where I wake up, where I develop some of these qualities that I've discovered? A feeling of wholeness, of contentment, or whatever, of openness, non-clinging. So then, naturally, there's a desire then to extend out the practice into normal life. And then people will often come and ask a teacher, "Well, this is all fine and good, this meditation practice, but how do I bring it into my normal life?" And as a teacher, it's always very gratifying when someone comes and says that, because it means that they've kind of understood that it has real value outside of just meditation. But also as a teacher, I don't have any pat or simple answer for that because everyday life is incredibly complicated and involved. So it's a matter of finding and negotiating your own way into that question. But to know that it's possible and interesting is very important. But in a sense, the mind of meditation, the mind outside, is not any different. And a lot of things you learn in the context of meditation practice is directly applicable to our outside life. So one of the simplest things is that bringing attention to our experience is always one of the options we have in any situation. It's like bringing attention is a kind of a doing. It's a very strange kind of doing which is not a doing. Someone likened it once, it's like dancing or playing music. The point of dancing or playing music is not to get to the end of the dance floor or to get to the end of the music piece. If that was the case, the fastest musician would be the best. And that's kind of silly. So, and same with meditation. It's not to get anywhere. It's not a kind of doing that has a goal. You know, I'm going to get this and be the best and kind of attain something or whatever. But it's a rather a kind of doing. It's like dancing or like playing music. It's the doing is in the activity in and of itself. So it's a kind of doing, but it's different than many of our goal-oriented activities. But it is always an option. You can bring this kind of doing into whatever is happening. And if you find yourself in very stressed, difficult, and confused situations, it's always nice to know you have this as an option. You know, rather than be confused and not know what to do, well, I'm going to start paying attention. What's going on here? What am I feeling? What's going on around me? And it can be very, very simple. It's not like you have to understand it, you know, all its complexity situation, but just what's the simple thing you can understand here? Oh, I'm confused and I'm tight and stressed, and just to feel that. And it makes a huge difference to bring attention. So you can always do it, bring attention. And then you begin understanding in meditation and outside how our mind works, some of the tricks of the mind, some of the habits and powers of the mind to go in certain directions, to be preoccupied in certain things, to overlay or project certain interpretations on who we are, who the world is. For example, if you think that you're unworthy, and so you're always kind of shy, and you always see other people as being, I was talking to someone today who writes a lot of academic journal writing, and she says that I was telling her my idea of academic writing is you're having a conversation with people. You're writing an academic article, you're not writing the truth. You're having a conversation with a whole other bunch of colleagues and people, and you're trying to find, slowly through this conversation, find something together. But her idea was that when she was writing an academic paper, she was writing for the perfect audience who knew everything better than her. And so that was a trick of her mind, that was a habit of her mind, and as she could see that, for many years was unconscious or subconscious. She didn't realize the stress she was under from always trying to write from that point of view. But as you started to see this trick or the habit of the mind to always want to project the imaginary perfect reader for her writing, she didn't have to be caught by that anymore. She can see it and let go of it, or see it and allow it to be there but not believe it, accommodate for it or whatever. So these are many ways in which we do this, an infinite number of ways in which we have opinions about who we are and who the world is and other people and things and the future and the past. And we get caught in that, we cling to it, and it creates a veil through which we kind of filter through which we see the world. So as we keep meditating and doing practice, we see some of these habits of the mind, and as we see them, we no longer have to necessarily believe them, and alternatives arise. So this is also the extension of practice in daily life, is to start noticing what our habits are and wisely deciding what we can do an alternative. Many people who want to bring the practice into daily life will do certain techniques or tricks of the trade, to help them to come into the present moment, because it's not so easy to stay in the present moment. You have tremendous power of mind to get caught and lost, and especially true if we're very busy. And many of us in our culture, it's an epidemic of busyness in our culture, and I'm afraid it's contagious. And it seems to be getting worse all the time, until we're all going to crash. Some people have already crashed and chosen healthy alternatives, but some of us are very busy. And so in the busyness, it's very hard to stay in the present moment, to notice what's happening to us as it's happening. That's another way of saying mindfulness, to notice what's happening as it's happening. So people have little tricks. And one trick is, there's all kinds of small ones some of you have heard about. One is when the telephone rings, if you have to answer the telephone a lot, don't grab for the phone at the first ring. But use the telephone as a bell of mindfulness. reminding you to pay attention. And so you let it ring three times. And during those three times, you sit there, maybe close your eyes and just breathe. Take two or three breaths. You know, nothing, the world's not going to come to an end if you don't get the phone. And if they hang up after one ring, then it's just as well. Anyway. So just take a few moments to kind of check. And it's hardly just a moment, a few moments to check in and see where you're at. Are you relaxed? Are you angry? Are you happy? Are you sad? You know, what's going on? And if you have a little bit better sense of where you're at before you answer the phone, you might answer the phone with more wisdom and understanding than if you're kind of grouchy and you kind of answer the phone and say, you know, something grouchy. And then you regret it because it's your boss or whatever. So just take a few moments to check in, to be with a breath, to kind of just for a few moments relax. It's very powerful. For a long time, I used doorways. Whenever I went through a doorway, that was my cue to pay attention, to come back into the present moment. And it made some sense because when you go through a doorway, you're entering into a new space. So it makes sense to wake up and notice what's happening. So I use doorways that way. And some people will do all kinds of things. Some people will choose certain activities during the day, which is their kind of awareness training activities or activities where they're going to develop intimacy or awareness. So some people will choose driving to work in the morning or coming home at the end of the day. They're going to use this, not going to turn the radio on, they're really going to be present, they're going to drive in somewhat of a sane manner and just stay aware and present and breathe and just be in a very simple way. Some people will do it a walking meditation as they walk. If they have to walk, for example, from their car to the place of business or whatever, as they get out of their car, to walk in a quiet, simple way, mindfully, with consciousness, not letting the mind kind of wander freely wherever it wants, but letting yourself kind of be in the fullness of the present moment. So there's many ways, you know, you can find your own cues. I know some people who put little dots, little stick-on dots, they'll put them on different things that they see during the day. And so that reminds them to pay attention. Like you can put it on your telephone. Or I know one person who put it on his on a clock. And he often looked at his clock. And so every time he looked at his clock, he would take a deep breath or just pay attention, notice what's happening. So different tricks of the trade to kind of help make it more reasonable or helpful to return to the present moment and find value in being in the present moment. If you don't find value in the being in the present moment, well, then you shouldn't bother anyway, probably. But as you find more value, I think it's more you're more motivated to want to do that, to be in the present moment. So, how many of you read Adair Lara today in the paper? So I'll read it. I thought it was very apropos to the class today. So she writes, the title is, Be Here Now, But Not on Purpose. I'm starting to resent being told to live in the moment. Uh-oh. I'm out of a job. A multitude of books glut the stores, all trying to bully us into applying this Zen insight to our lives. When I hear such advice, I want to say, well, I was going to live in the moment, but now you ruined it by telling me to. I myself did a book called Slowing Down in a Speeded Up World, filled with hundreds of excellent suggestions from ordinary people for how to do just that, how to notice when you're happy. Another good reason to be mindful. After I wrote it, I tried following the advice in it. I tried to pay attention to the warmth of the water as I rinsed dishes, to the sight of red roses against the blue sky, to the sight of wet clothes billowing on a line. I tried to remember to take my coffee out on the porch in the early morning and enjoy the light. The result was not a more serene, Zen-like me. The result was a more guilty me. I'd stand there fidgeting out on my porch, trying not to look at my watch and be annoyed to find that I couldn't even take 5 minutes to enjoy the morning without wanting to be on to the next thing. Enjoyed the morning light. Check it off. If humans were truly meant to live in the moment, more humans would already be doing it. Moments come when they want to and leave when they like. Trying to live in the moment is like trying to be happy. It doesn't work that way. You can't deliberately concentrate on the richness of the feast before you without having the groaning table vanish as if Samantha, unbewitched, had wriggled her nose at it. Happiness likes to come in by the side doors. Moments like to just happen. And to some degree, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. However, it's also true that we can develop and train our ability to be in the present moment. And it's a little bit mysterious how that happens. I mean, it certainly happens from our effort to try to do it. But even so, it seems mysterious as it kind of sneaks up on us in a sense. And maybe even your attempts to be in the present moment now, it isn't that you're successful or this is really kind of where you're going to see it develop, but rather by bringing the intention, bringing the effort to be present, it might be you find tomorrow you have a few more extra moments of being in the present. Or if you keep it up regularly for day after day, month after month, you'll find that in 6 months, you find that much more of your day is naturally in the present moment. It sneaks in through the side doors, as she says. So the effort is important, but we don't want to get caught up in measuring the success or failure of our efforts and what we've actually attained. It might not be, you know, in what you've attained in any one moment that's really important. So we try to be in the present moment. But then, as I said earlier, that's not the purpose of Buddhist practice, to be in the present moment. The purpose is to live in a life which is not clinging. And being in the present moment is an aid to learning not to cling, or it's an aid to understanding how we cling so we can stop clinging. It's very hard to understand how you cling in the present moment unless you're in the present moment to see it. So it's very valuable to be in the present moment. But also being in the present moment is kind of a byproduct of not clinging. If you don't cling to anything, you're not going to be very far away from a consciousness which rests fully and openly in the present moment. So as you let go of clinging, you'll find yourself living more in the present moment, which is a really real delight. So in this spirit, in my own practice, I'd like very much to think of synonyms or practice or use synonyms for the word mindfulness or awareness as I approach or as I bring the practice into my daily life. And part of what practice is to know what is the appropriate way to bring mindfulness in any given situation. So one synonym that I like in some situations, the word participation works better than mindfulness. Because mindfulness is a little bit more, you know, lends itself to kind of, well, separate from it, just really be there for it. Sometimes I like the word intimacy. What does it take to be intimate in this situation? Participating. So you can find your own words, perhaps, own kind of synonyms that work for you. You don't have to always, it doesn't have to always look like this funny word mindfulness, which is not really a Buddhist word because it's an English translation of a Buddhist word. And the Buddhist word itself didn't have the word mind in it. It just, you know, we're kind of mind-oriented in this culture. So we kind of call it mindfulness, and therefore it's about the mind, right? You know, I don't know if it's about the mind. You could just as easily, as I say, call it bodyfulness. You know, it's just about being embodied and experiencing the world through your body in all its senses, including the mind. Or maybe the stress should be on the word fullness. So mindfulness, heartfulness, the fullness of life, being in the fullness of how we're experiencing life in the present. Engagement is another synonym. How do you be engaged fully? And you'll probably find that a regular meditation practice, a formal meditation practice, and if on top of that you add bringing the practice into daily life, if you do that on a regular basis, you'll probably find that it makes a big influence, a big impact on your life. You'll find that your days are a lot easier, a lot smoother, less stressed. You might even find yourself being more efficient. And you, if you try it for some time, if you try it for 6 months on a daily basis, and then stop for some days or for a week or something, then you'll see. Sometimes the benefits kind of creep up and you don't see them until you stop. And then some of you might want to come on retreats, might find ways to develop deeper concentration in the meditation itself. And we do one-day retreats here in Palo Alto. We do longer retreats. Our center here is connected to Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which is in Marin. And we're building it there, and we do retreats there and elsewhere. There's about 14 teachers that I'm part of a kind of teaching collective, and through Spirit Rock. And you can go study with the different teachers. Each teacher has a different kind of slant or different strength or flavor, and so it's nice to get different teachers. So there's different ways of developing it, the practice. So before I go on anymore, maybe now I should turn it over to you and see if you have any questions or comments at this point.
I find it very helpful to be reading something connected with meditation every day. You know, I read about a book a week. And that, if I didn't have that, I think I would kind of lose it.
So maybe what you're pointing to is it's very sometimes can be very difficult to stay inspired or stay motivated to keep it up. And so there's various ways. So that's one of the ways to encourage and make it happen is to find ways to motivate oneself. One way is to sit with a meditation group once a week. It's very, very useful to sit with others, and it becomes kind of an infusion of enthusiasm, of sense, and it's really encouraging. So we sit here Thursdays and Mondays, and there are other meditation groups in the area. There's a Zen center in Mountain View, and we have a small sitting group in San Jose, and there's others, but I don't really know. Then you can just look around. But find something, someone, people you can sit with. Another way is, as you said, is to read something every day. And some people make it part of their regular routine in the morning, either before or after the meditation, to spend a little bit of time just reading some kind of a spiritual book that's somewhat inspiring or instructive. And some people will it can be just very short. There was a period in my own practice where I would just read a page of some Buddhist book or spiritual book, and I would just be overwhelmed and say, well, I have a lifetime of work just to apply that one page to my life. And so that was enough for that day. So it took me a lot longer than a week to get through a book. So that's another way of, so your way is very good, very nice way of maintaining the momentum and motivation. Yes?
Do you have your day retreats in Palo Alto? Are they here?
No, they're in different places. The next one will be at the Unitarian Church. The next two that we have, I'm not teaching the second one, another teacher is, will be at the Unitarian Church. And they're listed in our newsletter, which is out there. And then after that, they're going to be, I think, down the street here at the St. Mark's. Oh, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about letting go of the grasping?
Well, you could let go. Letting go is a very interesting subject, and Buddhist teachers will often talk about letting go, and for some Buddhists, that's their primary practice, is always letting go of everything. I don't talk about letting go as much as some teachers do, partly because it's easy to let go of inappropriate things. And if you make letting go a be-all and end-all definition of your practice, you can let go of things which are quite fine, nothing wrong with them. It's almost like a rejection of everything. What we're letting go of is the clinging. This is a very important distinction. We're letting go of the clinging, we're not necessarily letting go of things. But sometimes when we let go of the clinging, there's not much reason to hold on to anything, some of the things anyway. But anyway, we're letting go of the clinging and not things. And that tends to moderate the tendency of letting go of things, inappropriate things. Letting go gives a subtle illusion that you're in charge. That you're the agent who's doing all this. Now, some of you might think, well, what's wrong with that? I am, after all. How many of you think you're the agent in charge of your life and everything goes on and you can control, even yourself? How many of you can control your body? How many of you have some kind of control over what your mind thinks during a day? Huh? No one speaking up? But sometimes we act as if we have much more control than we actually have. And part of Buddhist practice is the deep insight that can happen is to realize that our life is a lot happier when we don't cling or hold on to some idea of an agent who's in charge. There's still responsibility. So it gets a little bit, involved. It's a discussion of it. But if you're always letting go, it gives you, it supports the idea that you're in charge. And a lot of bad habits can develop from that, and a lot of disappointments when you can't succeed. What we try to do in mindfulness is bring our attention and pay attention to what's happening at present moment very, very carefully. Oh, there's clinging. Wow. That's what clinging feels like. Wow, it's painful. Wow. You know, wow. And that's one option, you know, how to respond. And the other option is to go, oh shit, there's clinging. You know, that hurts to do that. It's more interesting. Wow. You know, there it is, whatever's happening. But as we bring our attention to something, what beautifully happens is that it lets go of itself. And then you discover this wonderful wisdom and trust that somehow your inner life takes care of itself if you just bring enough attention to it. You don't have to be the agent of actually doing the change. And that's actually more profound than learning, you know, better skills of letting go. Does that make sense? Is that, you want to say more? Or?
That's a very freeing feeling. You don't have to be in charge all the time.
Yeah. Exactly. But also it helps if you can be, in a kind of way, comfortable with discomfort. You're a lot freer if you're comfortable with discomfort than if you're always running away from it or reacting to it, resisting it. Yes?
About the Dharma.
The Dharma. What would you like to know? The Dharma is, there are 84,000 doors to the Dharma. Which door do you want? What interests you in Buddhism? Why are you here?
I guess getting rid of attachments.
Getting rid of attachments. So the Dharma of non-attachment. The way to the Dharma of non-attachment is to really become a connoisseur of attachment. Become the world-class expert in what attachment is all about. Don't become an expert on. Don't rush ahead towards non-attachment, because then it's kind of the same thing but letting go. So an attachment is something you can feel in your body. You can feel the discomfort of it. You can feel the pain of it in the mind, in the heart, the clinging and the holding of different parts of the body. So one of the ways to study the non-attachment is to enter the body more and feel it in the body. Feel the consequences in the body of holding and attachment. Feel the consequences in your life and the actions you choose, the responses you have to the things around you. Attachment in a Buddhist sense is not attachment, you know, I'm attached to my wife. That's okay, that's just kind of a nice thing. But attachment really means this hard clinging, you know, holding on for security, holding on for dear life, you know, and you have to have it this way or else, or you have to not have it this way or else. And it's said that the Buddha said that the person who understands clinging and non-clinging, the person who discovered the heart of non-clinging, has fully understood the Dharma. So rather than studying the 84,000 books on the Dharma, all you have to study is this thing that you brought up, attachment, clinging, and non-clinging, and see through it to the bottom. And it makes it very simple, actually. How's that?
The start.
Yes?
I have a question about this letting go issue, which I'm not sure if I understand really well. For me, to let something go would mean that something is not important, and I can just let it go. Whereas, and there is one more thing, almost all you say about meditation is about sort of...
Wait a minute. I feel very strongly about this. Yes. And I really feel like I need to say my point here. I'm really attached and I don't want to let go of my point because I don't want to let go of anything. So wait a minute. I don't want to hear what you have to say. I feel it's really important for me to kind of have my way and really... I don't want to let go of anything. Well, who are you to tell me I should let go of anything? And I think people should be more self-aware. excuse me. I took the opportunity to make a point.
Okay, just wanted to be sure.
Did you understand a little bit?
I met some comments from my friend who also sometimes says that she meditates. And there were comments like, You are sometimes angry that people don't use blinkers in America, right? Just let it go.
Oh, I see.
I may let it go, but I also think that it is not by not using blinkers. I'm not personally offended, but I feel that people don't, myself including, probably don't pay enough attention to other people.
Yes.
And to our actions, which are on other people. And this is actually my other question, because when you talk about meditation, you talk about feelings, about sort of feeling our body, observing our body. Everything is concentrated
yes.
on self. On the other hand, you said something today, like about awareness. Awareness is taking time, right? Taking time to have the feelings, observe ourselves. But is it about the outside world?
Also, yes, so very, very good point. So maybe if I remember the first one, I'll start with the second one. It does take time in a sense, but it doesn't mean changing what you're doing. It doesn't mean slowing down. It's taking the space in a sense to be aware of what's unfolding, what you're doing in time. You don't have to stop and create the time. You can keep doing what you're doing. However, what we're paying attention to is whatever is predominant in our experience, whatever is the main event in the situation. And in meditation, with our eyes closed, our own experience is the main event usually. Sometimes it sounds, sometimes it very occasionally smells. In normal life, a lot more other things are going on. And so it's appropriate maybe not to pay attention so much to what's going on within us always, but to really be there fully for, you know, for the activity that we're doing. I mean, if you're kissing your spouse or someone, she doesn't want to know necessarily that, you know, you're being intimately mindful of every single, you know, little thought and pattern going on. And, you know, wait, hey, I'm here. So there's, of course, there's some common sense, you know, but it's bringing attention to what wants attention now. And that's why I use like the synonym participation. Mm-hmm. We participate sometimes more than kind of pull ourselves back and be mindful. But as we develop mindfulness, this inner mindfulness in a sense, what we're doing is awakening a capacity to be aware with more than just our thoughts. And so we enter the situation and we have more resources of awareness, more antennas in a sense that are awake. And there's a kind of forgetting of self that happens, and we really become very keenly aware of the world also, if that's what's appropriate. Now, about letting go inappropriately. That's why I don't like talking about it a lot, letting go. When I was 20 and I was hitchhiking around and staying in communes around America, I was traveling around with a girlfriend, and at some point she lost her flashlight. And she was concerned because we needed a flashlight. We were sleeping out a lot. And I said, it's okay. You know, my attitude was like, everything's cool, man. Everything's okay, man. You know, you know how it was back then. You know, let go. Don't be attached. You know, who cares? And she was furious with me. And I think rightfully so. You know, you can overdo it. And it was a professor at Stanford I had who we were studying something and there was some minor historical point, and I said, that's not important for what we're doing, what we're studying. That's not important, I said. And he turned to me and he said, everything's important. And I think that's true. Everything's important. We never want to discount or dismiss anything. But dismissing and letting go, dismissing and non-clinging are two different things. The example that they use for the children's program at Spirit Rock is if you hold a bell like this, you really hold on tight. You know, but if you hold the bell lightly, if you don't cling to it, but hold it on lightly. So our life's the same way. If we hold it lightly, we get a nice sound out of our life. But if we cling, yes.
It's funny, sometimes I notice, you know, it's really easy for me to, not attached to anything. And I look back and I say, God, I can't believe how, you know, taxed I was before. And then other times, like this week, it's the opposite. You know, you're like, how could I, you know, I can't seem to let go. And, you know, you're kind of remembering that beautiful feeling of being able to, you know, stand back and not be so judgmental. But it's like a story you read almost. And, you know, you kind of cling to get it back because it was so nice.
Ah.
That doesn't help either.
If you want to live at ease, especially with mindfulness practice, it has to be okay to fail, because you're going to fail anyway. You're not going to always be able to do it, and so sometimes we get caught. And part of it all is to have an ease about the changes in your life. The ease with, now I'm caught, and that's what's happening. Okay, I'm completely caught and lost and everything. And yesterday I was fine and blissed out, but now I'm not. So I'm going to bring my attention to today. So the practice is bringing your attention to what's happening, not trying to get anywhere. So it's kind of a relief. You don't have to get back to that wonderful experience you had yesterday. And if you try too much, you actually cause suffering. And if you don't try too much, you're probably more likely to succeed. So it's very tricky, because the best way to get it is not to go for it, but then not going for it in order to get it. You know,
two weeks ago you talked about the cycle with anger.
Yeah.
I do that same cycle with being at ease, you know.
Oh.
Not at ease anymore, and at ease that you're not at ease.
So seeing it very clearly, seeing the pattern and all that, does it make it easier?
Sometimes not. Sometimes I can't break loose. It's kind of a cycle. It just kind of spins.
And sometimes if you absolutely can't break loose, you know, sometimes that's the best time, because as long as we're trying to break loose or using the practice to break loose, we have an agenda. And we're not really developing awareness, which is without an agenda. So it has to be okay to have things be completely wrong. So sometimes that's actually the most important place to develop mindfulness, is when things are really difficult. To see, you know, how we want things to struggle and fight and resist and all these things.
Is there like a learning curve that your plateaus?
Probably. Yeah, sure. Learning curve.
I mean, you know, you learn something and you level off.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, our human psyche or spiritual side of ourselves is so complicated, so many different levels. And I mean, just for example, there's the body and the mind and emotions. And so sometimes we learn something physically for a while and that plateaus, and then next lessons are more emotional, and next lessons are cognitive, and then other levels, motivation, we study. So yeah, makes sense. There are plateaus.
But that's not part of practice, becoming aware of them.
Well, usually you're not encouraged to pay attention to the progress you're making. It's usually not so interesting to evaluate, because evaluation of, you know, it's nice to know that it's, you know, it's useful and helpful, and you value it in your life. But to be monitoring, you know, where am I? I've gotten to stage X now, and I can look forward now to stage Y, and I'm not at Y yet, so what's wrong with me? And, you know, and it's better not to evaluate. Because the point of the practice, you know, it's a very funny way Buddhists talk. It's kind of like we talk out of both sides of the mouth. You know, on one hand, you know, I'll say, you know, the point of the practice is to become free. To be free of clinging and live a life that's compassionate and friendly and relaxed and all these things. On the other hand, I'll say the point of the practice is not to get anything. The point of the practice is not to accomplish anything or get anything from the practice, or, you know, the point of the practice is just to be aware of what's happening now. And the reason we can kind of talk out of both sides of the mouth at the same time is that the two are not so separate. The two can be kind of seen as being complementary to each other, these two ways. And the way to get free, the way to develop compassion, the way to let go of, to find non-clinging, is not to have any agenda about what you're doing in your practice, where you're going, and what you're trying to accomplish, but simply trust the power of bringing attention to this activity.
Yeah, I can relate to what this gentleman's saying, but also the article there, that really describes sometimes where I'm at with this, as far as, like, you know, it's like I'm. It's better that the practice seems to put me further away than where I was before.
It could be, yeah. So it's, and if there are people who kind of misunderstand the practice sometimes, or they apply it too mechanically. And so one way to misunderstand it is to think it means to be thoughtful of everything rather than mindful. And you know, the mindful way of doing everything. So there's a beautiful example. The speaker on Monday said he used to work for Smith and Hawkins, and it's a mail order company, and so they do pack a lot of boxes of stuff they mail off, you know, the shovels and stuff they sell, and they have to work very fast because it's a business, and it's very complicated because shovels and rakes and clippers and seeds, and they're all different shapes for a box, so you kind of, it's kind of like a puzzle to get it in the smallest possible box. And so this friend of mine, he was a Buddhist, and he was kind of like a boss type in a different part of the company. But there was, he helped or arranged for a Buddhist practitioner to get hired there. And after some days or some weeks, the boss of the packing division came to him and said, you know, I want to talk to you about this, you know, Buddhist. You know, I really, you know, you're kind of like the token Buddhist here, and you know, I'm hoping to understand. You explain to me what's going on with him. You know, and he's really, really slow. You know, I think he's not very accurate. You know, it's very important to be accurate when you're mailing all this stuff off. So, so he went to see this guy, and the guy, he asked the guy, you know, how's it going here? And, oh, it's so great. You know, it's so nice, and I can really be mindful of what I do, and really take the time and just, you know, really feel what it's like to put it down in the box, really be here, and it's just so nice. And then you look around, and these other guys, these young guys who are wearing Walkmans and kind of, you know, and they're going on dancing and throwing things down, and really kind of, and they're doing really fast work and really mindful work and really present work. But this guy here, he has an idea what mindfulness looks like. And he's kind of forced. And he's kind of like, mindfulness is to always, you know, be a certain way, always to kind of be thoughtful, or always kind of savor each moment in a particular way. That's only one fixed idea. And different kind of activities require a different kind of presence that's involved in mindfulness. So when I was working in a fast food restaurant, my idea of mindfulness practice was to pay attention to whatever kept me from surrendering to the activity. So my job was just to surrender to that activity, a dance, a very fast-paced dance. And whatever kind of resistance or whatever kept me from really surrendering, I noticed that and kind of let go of it. And I just kind of was there fully with the dance and would forget myself. But what the consequence is, if you forget yourself, is sometimes the old habits creep in and it hurts. But that's okay when we learn. So your point is very good. And I'm saying that, responding by saying that mindfulness is not always such a straightforward, easy thing. But it's an incredibly beautiful thing. It's an incredibly beautiful and valuable thing to use as a reference, to use as a tool, to use as a religious base for our life. And the point, again, is not mindfulness. The point is non-clinging. So clinging to mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is the cure for all illnesses, but clinging to mindfulness is the greatest illness. Maybe. Last one.
It's kind of like good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Yes. So now we've talked a lot, and it's 8:30, and I wanted us to sit more, so I hope you found the 5-week course valuable. And next week I'll just continue with other more instructions and stuff. And however, the schedule will change. Yes.
What's your name?
Oh, my name is Gil Fronsdal.
Nice to meet you, Gil.
Thank you. So I have a couple of announcements. One is I brought more of those books that I announced 2 weeks ago, I think, or last week, the Spirit Rock book, which is a nice, you know, if you want to read a book every.
I read that one already.
Oh, you read that one.
I'm going to your reading again.
And it's about 12 of the Spirit Rock teachers. It's a talk by each of them, so you get a flavor of each of the teachers, and they talk about the practice from different points of view. And so it's a nice book. It's out there if you want to buy it. The other thing which is very nice is that Sharon Salzberg is the one of the most senior Vipassana teachers in America, senior kind of Buddhist teacher in America. And she was one of my teachers, and someone who's very important for me, as a teacher for me, is going to come to Palo Alto to give a talk on Friday, June 20th. And it's going to be a kind of a East-West Books is arranging for it, and she's doing it as a benefit for local Buddhist study center. And it's going to be at the Ananda Church up on El Camino, near California Avenue. And I think it should be quite nice if you're interested in this and interested in mindfulness practice and interested in one of the best teachers, I think, in the country. Sharon is coming to our community. So there's flyers talking about it more out in the hallway in the table there. And I also have a couple of dozen tickets that I could sell to you if you want to buy it here. Otherwise, you go to East West Books and buy the tickets there. And they're $10. Friday, June 20th. And something else I should mention? Announcements? Is that enough? So I guess that's enough.
He says that Thursdays would continue except there's a change in schedule.
The change is that I don't talk as much. And same time, but we come and we sit, meditate for half an hour, and rather than starting with talking and whatever we do.
Is it silent or guided, the meditation?
It's mostly silent. At the very beginning, sometimes I say a few words in case there's new people, and then after that, I mostly silent. I've toyed with the idea of doing a guided meditation during that time. Sometimes I've done it later in the evening, a second meditation that's guided. And some of you might, we also have a sitting group on Monday evenings. And the subject of the two evenings is a little bit different in that Thursdays is more based on kind of more subjects that were more directly related to the meditation practice, more kind of for beginners in a sense. And Monday, the topic can be anything that seems remotely connected. So thank you all for this wonderful class, and I hope it was valuable.